of this case. We'll hear arguments first this morning in Herwig against Ray. Mr. Dodowitz, I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the case before you today presents this Court with familiar concepts of federal-state cooperative programs, federal regulatory issues, and specific elements of the Medicaid statute. Petitioners are a class of poor persons from the state of Iowa who are being deprived of Medicaid benefits for nursing home care solely because Iowa has chosen to disobey federal Medicaid regulations. The heart of the Medicaid problem here involves a determination of the amount of money available to an institutionalized spouse from a non-institutionalized spouse in determining benefit eligibility. This process is called deeming, and of course is the very same process confronted by this Court last term in its decision in Schweiker v. Gray Panthers. Whether or not deeming is employed for spouses separated by institutionalization, of course, often results in critical life decisions for members of the petitioner class. As a majority of this Court noted in Gray Panthers, many individuals in need of medical care are forced by deeming to choose between abandoning an institutionalized spouse and living in poverty. This dilemma is at the core of the present controversy. This case, like that in Gray Panthers, revolves around the validity of the federal regulations that determine when a state, such as Iowa, may deem income between spouses separated by institutionalization. Contrary to the plaintiffs in Gray Panthers, petitioners in this case are not attacking the validity of the federal regulations. Instead, it is the respondent, Iowa, who now claims, despite their acceptance of federal monies, that they are not bound by the Secretary's regulations. Iowa argues it may make its own deeming rules directly contrary to the federal regulations and still be reimbursed by the federal government for Medicaid payments. Petitioners maintain, on the other hand, that the federal regulations are a valid exercise of the Secretary's authority granted to him by Congress, and the federal government, as stated in their amicus brief filed herein, agrees with petitioners that Iowa's Medicaid rules must be changed in order to comply with the federal regulations. The analysis which this Court must employ in evaluating this controversy was set forth by the Court in its decision last term in Gray Panthers. The regulations at issue in this case are promulgated under the exact same statutory authority for which the regulations of Gray Panthers were promulgated. In the Gray Panthers case, this Court ruled that the section of the Medicaid Act under which the Secretary was acting, both in Gray Panthers and here, amounted to Congress's granting to the Secretary the power to make regulations that have legislative effect. The Court therefore applied its previous decision in Batterton v. Francis in order to determine the validity of the regulations. The Batterton test requires that the regulations be upheld unless they are either arbitrary or capricious or beyond the authority granted the Secretary by Congress. It is important to note that neither the District Court in this case nor Judge Ross, writing for half of the Eighth Circuit, followed the Batterton test. The only group of judges that did was the second half of the Eighth Circuit, in an opinion written by Judge McMillian, who followed the Batterton test and came out on the same side as petitioners are herein, indicating that the regulations must stand and Iowa's rules must fall. The practical implications of the Batterton-Gray Panther test are that this Court must focus on the reasonableness of the Secretary's regulations. It is not the duty of this Court to interpret the statute to see if there is another way to read the statutes, nor is it the duty of this court under Batterton and Gray Panthers to compare Iowa's interpretation of the secretary's to determine whose might seem most reasonable. The question is not really whether Iowa's policy is reasonable, which is what Iowa seems to want to argue to this court. The only issue is whether the secretary's regulations are reasonable. If they are, then they must stand, and Iowa must be forced to follow them. The Gray Panthers decision is not, however, controlling on the ultimate merits of this case, for the reason that the regulations at stake in Gray Panthers ultimately did not apply to the state of Iowa. Under the statutory authority of the Medicaid Act that we are concerned with, the Secretary issued, in a sense, two sets of regulations, one that applied to states which have been called the 209B states, and another set of regulations that applied to the SSI states. At stake in Gray Panthers were the regulations applicable to the 209B states. At stake here are the regulations applicable to the SSI states. That distinction is what produces the critical difference in this case.
Mr. Dudovitz, did Mrs. Hurwig's family apply on her behalf for SSI benefits before applying for Medicaid?
The record reflects that she did not apply before. And I think the briefs will note that there's some question about whether or not she, in fact, ever was an SSI recipient. However, the court will note, and attached to the appendix in this case, is the decision of the Iowa Department of Social Services on the Hurwigs. And they note in that decision that as of June 1977, they had received notice that as of June 1977, she was going to receive SSI.
Well, is there a reason why no application was made on her behalf?
I actually do not know the answer to why she did not make a specific application. It's my understanding that she would have been eligible after the first month that she moved out of the home. The difference between the 209B and SSI distinctions, as I said, is critical here. The 209B option, as this court noted in Gray Panthers, was created by Congress essentially at the behest of the states because the states did not want to be bound by what we have called the SSI link. That link, that part of the statute, 1396A10A, requires that a state provide Medicaid benefits to all SSI recipients. This link to categorical programs, that is, linking Medicaid eligibility to eligibility for categorical programs, was not new. It's essentially existed in the Medicaid program from its inception. The critical difference, though, that occurred in 1972 was the adoption by Congress of the SSI program. Prior to that time, the states were able to control many of the eligibility conditions for the categorical programs. Therefore, to link eligibility to those programs did not still allow the states to have substantial control over the eligibility conditions. By federalizing the aid to the aged, blind, and disabled in SSI, Congress created the eligibility conditions for supplemental security income. That would have resulted in some states, if the link had been continued to apply to them, having to pay Medicaid benefits to people they had not paid them to before. In order to not force the states to have to do this, Congress provided the 209B option, which allowed states to use its eligibility conditions that were in existence in January 1972 rather than be bound by the SSI rules. States had a voluntary choice to make. Iowa chose to be bound by the SSI rules. Iowa chose to follow the SSI rules for Medicaid eligibility, as of course did a majority of the states. It's important to remember that the link then assures that all SSI people, All people who are so poor that they need cash assistance will also get corresponding medical benefits. And it attaches to Medicaid the eligibility conditions for those benefits that Congress crafted in the SSI statute.
Mr. Dudovitz, may I ask you a question, which is, if we were to reverse in this case and give effect to the Secretary's regulation, would states still be able to collect money from the spouse who's not institutionalized for reimbursement to the state under some state relative responsibility law, in your view?
Yes, absolutely. The Medicaid rules here and the SSR rules say nothing about the state's powers under its relative responsibility laws. In fact, the Secretary has noted a number of times that the states are free to exercise their rights, whatever they may be, under those laws.
Does Iowa have such a law?
It's my understanding that Iowa does have such a law. The particular SSI eligibility rules that are being brought to the Medicaid program through the link here, the deeming rules, are simply that spouses, when they live together, must have their income included together. And when only one spouse is an eligible spouse, has only one spouse applying for benefits, that deeming must cease after the first month. When two spouses are applying, the SSI requires that their income be considered together for 6 months. And correspondingly, the Secretary requires that same six-month deeming in the Medicaid program. Iowa admittedly does not follow that rule and admits that they are directly and specifically in violation of those regulations. The Secretary's regulations, then, in our view, when evaluated, that is, that regulation bringing the one-month and six-month rule over from SSI to Medicaid, when evaluated under the Batterton-Gray Panthers test, which this Court has established, balance the overall policies of the Medicaid program, that is, the attached assuring that categorical eligible people, SSI people, get Medicaid, with Section 17 B and D of the Medicaid Act that give the Secretary the power to determine what income is available and talk about the limited exception to deeming for spouses and parents to children. The regulations recognize, therefore, that Section D, the authorization for the limited deeming, and I think it's important again to note that this Court recognized that Congress generally was opposed to deeming but allowed a limited exception, recognized that D is such a limited exception. But it also recognized that the subsequent enactment by Congress of the SSI program in 1972 amounted to a modification of Section D, such that D could not be used to deprive SSI recipients of benefits.
Mr. Dudovitz, let me ask, does your class encompass both the categorically and the optional categorically needed?
Yes, it does. There's no distinction in the class between the two.
Does the regulation that was struck down apply only to the optional categorically needed?
It's my understanding that the regulation would apply to everyone, both the SSI recipients and the optionals. It's important to recognize that, as I think both our brief and the brief of the federal government points out, that the optional categorical people are in effect categorical people, and that the federal government has always applied the same rules to all of them, and the Secretary has always understood that it was the intent of Congress that they be treated the same. Again, recognizing that the optionals was a voluntary choice by the state of Iowa. They did not have to choose to cover those people, but that was their choice to do so. The Secretary's regulations, then, are no more restrictive than the SSI deeming rules, which the same, with the same states have to use. And it is, in our view, the only way to assure that the SSI link has effect. Iowa, to our knowledge, is by itself in its interpretation of these rules and statutes. The only other state, to our knowledge, that has ever argued that they can ignore these deeming rules was the state of Florida. And as I think we noted in our briefs in the Griswold case, the federal district judge enjoined Florida from undertaking their view. The federal government has always agreed with the position of the petitioners. Simply that the simple question is that if Iowa can do what it is trying to do here, if it can be an SSI state, but then pick and choose which SSI rules it wants to use in the Medicaid program, it effectively emasculates the link and deprives the federal government of any opportunity to control the Medicaid program for which it is the primary funder. Another interesting point in this case is that, if you look at the Department of Social Services decision attached to the appendix in this case, you will note that there were two federal SSI rules brought over to the Medicaid program which were at stake initially in the Hurwitz case. One was the deeming question, and the other was the income disregards question. That is, how much of Mr. Hurwitz's income would be disregarded under the SSI rules. Iowa chose to change that also initially. But in its decision on the Hurwitz case, it reversed itself. It said, we are bound to follow the SSI income rules for the Hurwitz. Therefore, we have to use the SSI exemptions. But we are not bound to follow the SSI deeming rules. Petitioners submit that makes no sense under a federal-state cooperative program. Iowa has made a few arguments that I wish to deal with at this point. One, they have implied that there is somehow some inherent power on the state of Iowa to do deeming through the Medicaid program. So I indicate in response to Justice O'Connor's question, Iowa's inherent power, to the extent it exists, is found in the relative responsibility laws. The Medicaid program is a federal-state cooperative program. Iowa doesn't have any inherent powers there. What a federal-state cooperative program does is Congress says that these are the rules. If you want to use federal money, you have to agree to follow the rules. And Congress determines who has the power to set the rules. Seems clear here that they've given the Secretary the power in this area. Section 17D is not mandatory, and again is modified by Congress's subsequent enactment of the link. I think it is again important to recognize that in evaluating federal-state cooperative programs like the Medicaid program and the AFDC program, this Court must look at the overall policy and intent of Congress. As Justice Rehnquist noted in the Philbrook case, it's not just one sentence or one word that's important here. It's the entire overall policy. And there is no question that the overall policy is to ensure that SSI recipients receive Medicaid. Second major point that I think Iowa tries to make is they try to argue that SSI program does not actually require that there be no deeming after 1 month. And they imply that that's, in fact, the Secretary's idea rather than Congress's. In SSI, however, Congress specifically in statute set forth in great detail most of the eligibility rules. Not only did they talk about only deeming in 1 month and 6 month times, but in Section 1382A2, where they defined unearned income once people are separate for all persons, including when people are separated, they indicated that support and maintenance can be considered unearned income only if supplied in cash or in kind. It's not the Secretary, but it is Congress that set forth these SSI deeming rules that the Secretary is now brought over to the Medicaid program by virtue of the link and his authority under 17B. Seems to me that it is perfectly reasonable for the Secretary, balancing all these interests, to use Congress's enacted eligibility conditions in the Medicaid program as a way to effectuate the link. If there are other questions, I'll save the remainder of my time for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Very well. Before you proceed, counsel, let me inform you and waiting counsel that it now appears that Mr. Justice Marshall cannot get through because of traffic conditions and snow, and he will participate in these cases on the basis, of course, of all the briefs that are filed, the record, and on the tape recording of the oral argument. He reserves that right. Mr. Appel, you may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please members of the court. In addition to responding to whatever questions you may have, I think it would be most helpful if I focus on four general areas of this case. First, I think we have to understand precisely what the regulation under question here does. It stands for the following proposition. If I am a wealthy lawyer earning $100,000 a year, and I have a spouse who, for whatever medical reason, needs to be institutionalized in a skilled 24-hour a day nursing home, a person representing the Iowa Department of Social Services cannot deem my income available to the spouse that's institutionalized beyond a one-month period. The only alternative for the state of Iowa is to use spousal responsibility statutes that Justice O'Connor referred to. With respect to those spousal responsibility statutes, I'd like to point out that the court in Gray Panthers was rather explicit in outlining how impractical resort by administrative agencies like the Iowa Department of Social Services to spousal responsibility statutes are. The difficulties of obtaining service, there's a protracted litigation, and it's almost out worth the candle sometimes.
But in the example that you're giving, of course, of the wealthy non-institutionalized spouse, it shouldn't pose such a problem, should it?
Well, except when you get a multiplicity of cases. We're not dealing with 10, 15. You could have quite a few. It's somewhat like the Child Support Recovery Program, which we have. Now, that's a little different in part because there's no federal largesse involved, and therefore we have a little higher standard. We've got to serve process, and we've got to have the court proceeding. But here we're linking it to Medicaid benefits that are actually paid. But that's the effect of the regulation at bar here. Secondly, I'd like to clarify models of adjudication that are really, really at issue here. And the petitioners in the state of Iowa have distinctly different models. The petitioners have a legislative effect model. And basically what they're saying is that Health and Human Services has kind of sketched in the details of the congressional statute, and that therefore the regulation involved is entitled to legislative effect. The theory that you're all, of course, familiar with is that specialized agencies ought to fill in those gaps. This court doesn't sit as kind of a super agency to review close decision-making. But Iowa has a distinctly different model. Iowa's model is an ultra vires model. It says that the Secretary of HHS, in creating this one-month iron curtain on deeming, is not sketching in detail, but is totally outside the congressional framework. And as a result of that, this is an area where courts traditionally police the agencies. And since the regulation involved is invalid, it has no effect from the beginning, and Iowa is not in violation of any valid regulation promulgated by the Secretary. So those are the two models, I think, and they're distinctly different, and that might give the case some focus. Let me share with you some of the reasons why Iowa believes the ultra vires model is more applicable than the legislative effect model. First, we go to the statute itself, Section 17B and D of the Medicaid program itself. Basically, what this statutory framework says is that the states must promulgate reasonable standards for Medicaid. 17B notes that the state can only consider available income, quote, according to standards prescribed by the Secretary, quote. And then 17D talks about spousal deeming of income. And basically 17D says that other than spouses, you can't deem income because consanguinity isn't close enough. But spouses is authorized. Now, the court in the Gray Panthers case construed that provision, 17D. And in 17D, it said, unless we hold this as express authorization for the states to deem the income of spouses, it would be superfluous. It'd be meaningless. It's a little awkward. It doesn't expressly grant the states the authority to deem spousal income, but it knocks everyone else out. It knocks out brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles. But in Gray Panthers, if you read the case carefully, it states clearly that unless you construe 17D to mean states you can deem spousal income, it would be literally stricken from the statute. Secondly, in Gray Panthers, there's a gloss of legislative history. I don't want to protract that, but one of the Senate committee reports that's cited there states that it is proper to expect spouses to support each other. I think that comports fairly with our everyday experience. Secondly, let me point out the Secretary has not promulgated a standard, really. Iowa's position is that it's a time limitation that has no connection at all with the availability of income, how much money the other spouse is making, what the obligations of the other spouse might be, on the strength of the marriage relationship.
Would Iowa object to any time limitation that the Secretary might impose on deeming?
I think it would be conceivable that a time limitation would be appropriate if it could be shown that it has some kind of rational relationship with expectations of spousal support. If the Secretary, in notice and comment in the Federal Register, said, listen, we decided that after 6 years or 5 years, the family obligation dilutes, or practical experience shows that we just can't enforce it. Well, I'll strike that. I don't mean to say that. But if experience shows us that somehow the family relationship is so diluted then that you can't expect it, then perhaps. For instance, in the Dandridge case, we're talking about standard of need for AFDC and in Rosaldo as well. And it's described by this court as a yardstick, a measuring device. It's something like standard review that the court uses. You can have a stringent standard of review in First Amendment cases, or a lax standard of review, as we have in agency cases where legislative effect is given to the regulation. But what the Secretary has done is, in fact, said no standard of review, no standard, but it's kind of brought down a time limitation that's irrational.
Hasn't Congress delegated to the Secretary, though, that precise power, and doesn't that mean that the Secretary's, Congress's directive has been effectively ignored, if you're right?
I think Congress's delegation must be considered in the context not only of 17B, which says standards, but 17D as well. And I don't think that the Congress intended for the Secretary to be able to use a one-month cutoff that has no relationship whatever to spousal responsibility. In effect, what that does is, through regulation, draw a dotted line through 17D of the statute. And I think that is ultra vires. The Secretary clearly has power to prescribe standards and draw the lines. The Secretary may come in and say, listen, it is unreasonable to expect more than $300 of income deemed to the other spouse from a person who earns $15,000 or wherever they set the line. Those lines are entitled to legislative effect. Iowa could not come before the court and say, you know, we think it ought to be $300, not $200, and we think the upper income ought to be $50,000 instead of $40,000. Those kind of lines are entitled to legislative effect.
General Apple, we haven't heard from the Solicitor General of the United States in this case, have we, on the merits? He filed a brief at the time the petition for cert was pending.
No, we have an amicus brief from HHS. On the matter. The brief, if I can characterize it, basically follows the petitioner's argument.
Well, General, you had, did the court below split evenly?
It did, 4-4. And in fact, I think the split.
What do you think about it when eight judges split evenly as to whether or not the statute is at least ambiguous? And if it is, what about your ultra vires argument?
Well, whether or not a statute is ultra vires can be a close call. And in fact...
Well, if it is, do you leave any room at all for any deference to the Secretary's judgment as to which side to choose on this ambiguity?
Not on this particular one, because I think...
Well, it must not be ambiguous then.
Well, the congressional directive is pretty clear in 17D, it seems.
But the four judges below were against it. They at least thought it was sufficiently ambiguous to vote the other way.
Well, and the reason for that, I think, is that they misapplied the Batterton test. Batterton test, I'd suggest, is not applicable in this precise setting. Why is it not applicable? First, in Batterton, Batterton's an interesting case, and it somewhat tracks the case, but let me distinguish it while it's open to the court. Batterton, as I'm sure you recall, was a case that involved unemployment benefits, and the Health and Human Services had a regulation which allowed states to disqualify families from AFDC benefits if the father became unemployed because of illegal activity that might have disqualified the father from unemployment benefits under state law, unlawful strike, that kind of thing. And the Batterton case made a couple observations. First, it noted that there was no indication in the statutory language or history that this factor could not be taken into account. That's at 432 U.S. 425. Au contraire, here we have the Express 17D, which has been held that it allows spousal deeming. Other than that, it's going to get stricken. It's stricken from the statute. And so, therefore, it's distinguishable there. Second, in Batterton, it was conceded that the Secretary could not adopt a regulation that has no meaningful relationship to any recognized concept of unemployment, or that would defeat the purposes of Medicaid. Let me put this in context of the present case. What meaningful relationship does this one-month window have toward the availability of income of the non-institutionalized spouse to the other? Not yet in this case has that regulation been defended on the ground that it's some kind of reasonable interpretation of what's available or not. The only ground that has been asserted is that because it's used in SSI, therefore it has to be used in SSI states under Medicaid. So there's a kind of an administrative jump, but nowhere is a rational relationship shown between the one-month window and deeming policy generally.
You agree that Batterton did hold that the original judgment was for the Secretary and that the court should set it aside only if it was unreasonable or irrational.
Or exceeded the statutory authority.
Exceeded the statutory authority, not simply because the court might have thought it would have come down with a different regulation if it had been entrusted with that authority.
Well, you know, I think that the different models have to be kept in point. Sure, that is precisely what the court said. However, it seems to me that the judgment of whether or not a regulation is outside the congressional framework, specifically where you have the clear 17D authorization, is something far different than kind of the line drawing that otherwise occurs in the guts of administrative statutes that this court construes daily.
General Apple, may I ask a question to be sure I understand your argument? Am I correct in believing that the same deeming regulation is used to determine eligibility for SSI benefits as for the Medicaid benefits? The one-month rule.
Oh, yes, that's correct. Yes.
And your argument that it's arbitrary in the case of Medicaid would apply also to eligibility for SSI, then, wouldn't it?
Well, not necessarily.
Well, why not? That's what I'd be interested
in. Right. In the SSI statute itself, there are provisions which appear to set up the one-month window. There's a specific statutory provision of SSI, I think it's 1382, it's cited in the briefs, that basically says implies you can deem the income when the spouses are living together. And HSS has said, well, that means living together, that means if they're separated, we can't deem any income. Query whether that's correct. But that's the approach that's been taken by HHS under SSI. And what the petitioner's argument is, as I understand it, is that because that's what goes on under SSI, that's what's got to happen under Medicaid.
But are you arguing that it's arbitrary for the Secretary to impose that requirement, but arguably with respect to SSI, Congress imposed the requirement, and the same standard of arbitrariness doesn't apply to Congress as does the Secretary? Is that the case?
Well, I think that's right. I think if the Congress, frankly, in many legislations,
can
be as arbitrary as it wants.
Congress can act arbitrarily, but the Secretary can't.
Well, I think that's correct.
But, I mean, that's basically what you're saying to us.
I think that...
Because if it is arbitrary, I suppose it's arbitrary whoever imposed the requirement.
I am saying that in this discussion, but I don't think it's critical to the guts of Iowa's case, which again rotates around the fact that 17D expressly allows the states to establish some kind of deeming policy, subject to whatever standards The Secretary might set for what's acceptable deeming. I might note that in Norman v. St. Clair, which is admittedly a circuit court case, but it describes some of the history of what occurred prior to the passage of some of these consolidating statutes. And indeed, in all kinds of, in all the states under the Kerr-Mills program, you had all different kinds of formula for deeming, and they're all different directions. And the idea was to kind of consolidate these together and get one general parameter of where deeming was allowed. That's the standard that the Secretary should promulgate. The Secretary should come out and say, listen, again, here's a matrix, like in Dandridge, or Rosaldo actually has a matrix. Here's a matrix of the standard of deemability. Beyond a certain threshold, you can't deem states. Let's get it all together. But again, we're writing out 17D of the statute, out of the Medicaid statute. And I want to point out the difference, too, between Medicaid and SSI. SSI, as the Court is aware, is a federal program, totally federal funded, has a much different philosophy than Medicaid. The Medicaid is a cooperative state program. The states are in fact directed to establish plans with all kinds of options and discretions and so forth. That's what Section 17 is all about. Now, by passing SSI, it seems to me Congress did not intend to take the state discretion expressly given in 17D for deeming out of the Medicaid program. Let me point out this 209B matter that's been raised with the court. And it's been suggested in the briefs that Iowa's trying to get in the back door.
If you win this case, I take it that Iowa couldn't change its mind. And
Iowa could go back and become a 209B state, yes, if it chose.
But as long as it's a 209B state, it may not take the course the Secretary says it must take.
No, in fact, if we were a 209B case, I think under Gray Panthers, we could have a much broader deeming regulation.
You mean you could choose to do it the other way?
Well, if we said, listen,
you mean that you could choose to follow the to ultra vires pattern?
No. Iowa is the so-called SSI state.
Yes.
It has the option of becoming a 209B state, which under Gray Panthers allows broader deeming. But Iowa doesn't want to do that. Why doesn't Iowa want to become a 209B state? Number of reasons. One, under SSI, there's expanded benefits to minor handicapped children, and there's a more liberalized threshold requirement, more liberalized financial eligibility requirements. In fact, Iowa has taken a liberal approach. To go back to 209B.
Let me ask you just a slightly modified version of Justice White's question. Supposing you remain an SSI state, would you then agree that you could not adopt new regulations that are precisely like the Secretary's regulations?
Oh, yes, that's correct.
You could not do that because that would be wholly
arbitrary.
That is correct.
That is correct.
That's so
really,
that every
that's really
state,
my question. That's, thank you very yeah. much, Mr.
And every state in the country that has followed the federal regulation has invalid regulations.
I think that's correct. Moreover, let me. That has this 1 month. Let me draw the court's attention to the fact that under a state's Medicaid policy, all of its standards that are set up under Section 17 must be reasonable, or they get struck down. So if Iowa or any other state had some kind of draconian deeming policy that tried to squeeze blood out of a turnip, that would be unreasonable under the statute. And so this forced choice business of driving someone into abject poverty in order to make to satisfy the deeming policy may indeed be unreasonable and is subject to judicial attack on that ground. And again, let me make very clear, Iowa is perfectly prepared to follow whatever standards are set by the Secretary. That's his prerogative. That's what 17B says, deeming according to standards. But we want to be able to deem spousal income as we're expressly authorized. And that's what's being cut off. Again, to put the 209B option in focus, we're talking about a narrow part of the Medicaid program. According to the Federal Register, only 7% of institutionalized persons actually have spouses. They tend to be elderly. And of those 7%, many of them have very little income at all. They're also eligible spouses, and so there's no deeming to be done. We're talking about a narrow case here.
So it isn't going to cost the state of Iowa very much.
Well, it does because the whole Medicaid liability, the state of Iowa, is tremendous. It runs into millions and millions of dollars. I think $200 million may be near accurate. Co-counsel suggests it is. And so even a small fraction, I don't have an accurate figure for how much this would cost the state of Iowa because our...
That was my point. This issue isn't going to cost the state of Iowa very much
if
you lose it.
No, I'm not convinced of that. I think, though it's not going to cost, it's not half of the $200 million in total Medicaid cost. Nursing home care is a large part of the overall $200 million. And if it costs $1 million or $500,000, and I don't have that figure in part because our Medicaid deeming is administered locally, so I don't have a centralized figure. But if it costs $500,000, that's a lot of service. And Iowa wishes to maintain its liberal policies.
It's a lot of corn, isn't it?
It sure is.
But
well, at these prices, not so much.
Doesn't that depend in part on the extent to which Iowa is willing to apply its own relative responsibility laws and recoup money?
It could.
Yeah, I mean, it's really up to Iowa how much it loses.
If we chose to pursue relative responsibility, I'm not sure how much income we could get. We'd have to hire new attorneys. We'd have to pursue service of process. I do know that in our child support recovery operations in our own office, we have 7 or 8 attorneys, and they're traveling around the state. And I might point out that those attorneys under Iowa law are paid for out of the social services budget. So for every dollar we expend on attorney to, you know, litigate these cases, it's coming out of social services generally. I don't know whether the expenses would be worth. It'd certainly be an administrative burden. And again, the court in Gray Panthers, I thought was rather clear on that point. A few other miscellaneous observations, if I may. Again, I want to stress the narrowness of this case. We're not challenging the whole SSI and Medicaid concept. If Congress tomorrow passes a statute that adds another category to SSI benefits, generally, we're moving right along. Iowa will adopt it because it is an SSI state. If Congress adds 5 categories tomorrow, Iowa will move right along. It is an SSI state. The only thing we're saying is the Medicaid statute expressly allows us to do spousal deeming, and we want to do so in a reasonable fashion. To hold otherwise is really a repeal of 17D by implication if we allow the Secretary's regulation to stand. And that, I think, is quite a dubious proposition where there's no express statutory provision overriding it. Let me close by saying that Iowa is interested in concentrating its resources on those most in need. That's the name of Medicaid. That's the purpose it was passed. And a reasonable deeming regulation does just that. It avoids the prospect of having lawyers riding circuit across the state trying to litigate the cases that was disproved, the process which was disproved in Great Panthers. It provides that relatively wealthy spouses will not have an opportunity to slide out of their Medicaid obligations. It focuses our dollars. And, you know, whatever the financial impact is on this case, it's going to mean there's less money for something else. Maybe Iowa will have to abandon its policy of having optional needy in Medicaid. Maybe Iowa goes back to a 209B state if the pressures get so great, which we think is an undesirable policy because of the lowered eligibility and because of the impact it have on minor children. We don't want to be a 209B state, emphatically. But we think that the policy adopted by the Secretary of HHS simply is contrary to the statutory framework. It's contrary to 17D of the statute. It doesn't make sense in terms of the general policy of deeming, since family obligations continue over time. They don't change after 1 month. They remain the same. Administrative enforcement is the only way to go. This is a case of ultra vires action by the Secretary, not a case of line drawing entitled to legislative effect. I'm open to questions.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Dudovitz?
I would like to just clarify a couple of points, Your Honor. I want to emphasize again that nobody has mandated anything on the state of Iowa. There are lots of choices, and point out a point that I think was neglected a second ago, that while Iowa can become a 209B state, and they can have more liberal eligibility rules than they had in 1972, they just cannot have any more restrictive rules. So Iowa's 209B program isn't definite, specifically mandated to be exactly as it was in 1972. It just can't be more restrictive. So if they want to add a few more people under the 209B program, they absolutely can. Secondly, I would note again that Section 17D is not mandatory. Section 17D is permissive. And the problem in the Gray Panthers case was the argument was being made that there could be no deeming in the Medicaid program. What this court held is a secretary must allow at times that there be deeming. Second important distinction is what we were dealing with, or what this court was dealing with in the Gray Panthers decision in interpreting B and D, was what Congress intended in 1965 when it enacted the Medicaid program. Again, Congress modified the Medicaid program a number of times, particularly in 1972 when they dealt with the change of the link and how its effect is on the SSI program. That, by doing that, essentially, Congress almost, in some sense, said that legislative history at the time B and D was adopted does not quite have the same meaning. So even if it might have been stronger in 1965, the requirement of the link to the SSI program, which no one seems to deny here, essentially modifies it. It makes it clear the Secretary is reasonable in saying, look, you can deem sometimes. And remember, Iowa can deem sometimes. In fact, it can deem the extent that the Congress found it reasonable to deem in the SSI program a program for poor people, so that the wealthy spouse that my brother talked about would, in fact, get SSI. That what the Secretary did is make a reasonable balance between the needs of the link, the permissiveness of D, but not the mandatory nature of D. And in that conjunction, I want to point out again that it's not the Secretary who set up those deeming rules in SSI. It is Congress. We are not talking about a question of the Secretary so-called misinterpreting the SSI deeming rules. And I refer again to Section 1382AA2A, which is the definition of unearned income in determining eligibility for an SSI recipient enacted by Congress, which indicates that you cannot consider support and maintenance unless provided in cash or in kind. Finally, I would like to reiterate the distinct difference, I think, between the arguments that were being made in Gray Panthers, the arguments that were being made here with regard to state relative responsibility laws. What this court was addressing in Gray Panthers when it noted the inadequacy of the relative responsibility law was the argument that the Gray Panthers had made that the relative responsibility laws are the only mechanism. And when the court made a notation to the transcript of the oral argument that counsel had acknowledged the difficulty of getting relief to the relative responsibility, counsel was talking about those close cases where it would be just as difficult, in fact, very difficult to expect a state to order it. In a wealthy, situated wealthy spouse, it's not very difficult to enforce the relative responsibility laws. And the relative responsibility laws we're talking about here are in addition to, not the only remedy, and that is the state can still do deeming under Medicaid for the 1 month and 6 month period, and in addition, has its relative responsibility laws for a remedy. So it seems to me a distinct difference between the problem that this court was referring to in its notation in Gray Panthers. I have nothing further unless there are any other questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...